One of my favorite prayers in our Book of Common Prayer is also one that I struggle with. The prayer can be found in the service of Compline, the last of our set of daily services. And it's this prayer where we ask God to protect us through the hours of this night, so that we who are wearied by the changes and chances of this life may rest in the eternal changelessness of God. I find great comfort in the prayer because it names the changes and chances of this world. It's a theological statement that acknowledges the reality of random chance and just how tiring and difficult real change can be. But it's that second part, the part about God's changelessness. This is the part where I struggle. What does it mean for God not to be changed? I realize that we want to trust in something that we can fundamentally count on. A being, an entity, a force that is ultimately and positively good. But I also wonder if something else is at work here. Are we anxious about the changeability of God because, well, maybe then God could be proved wrong? Or maybe because then God could be accused of being arbitrary? But in a world that keeps changing, as it is constantly being recreated, what would it mean for God to change? What would it mean for God to be changeless? Why does it matter so much? Those who have traveled with me around the Bay Area, whether in a car or on a bus or on foot, may have had a particular experience. It's what happens whenever I pass by some kind of historical landmark, be it a post-1906 fire clinker bricks, or the way that the UC Berkeley campus is oriented right towards the Golden Gate, or the East Brothers Lighthouse, which is a bed and breakfast actually situated in San Francisco Bay. These are all places where some kind of history has happened, and often I cannot pass by without telling that story to whomever happens to be nearby. It seems to be part of my essence, my being, and at least so far as I've been told, it's mostly interesting and helpful. The first time. But in case you hadn't heard it, I'll offer it again. Apparently, it's part of what makes me me. Perhaps part salt and perhaps part light. I think that's actually what salt and light are for, right? They are these entities, these components, these elements that enhance or illuminate the things around them. That's why salt has been so historically prized, because it can both protect and enhance the food it encounters. And why light, in a world without electric light, was so critical, because then people could see what was otherwise obscured. So maybe, actually, when we hear these questions that Jesus asks in this gospel today about salt and light, maybe they actually aren't questions that we are supposed to answer. But instead, maybe they serve as a rhetorical device. In fact, there are some who say that Jesus is actually making jokes here. but you just can't quite hear his tone of voice. Because how can you take away the saltiness of salt? You can't. It is what it is. Or in a world where a lamp always meant an open flame, who places a highly flammable bushel basket over the open flame? No one, because then you get much more than light. And so this is probably the response that Jesus is going for, because these are ridiculous and preposterous ideas to do either of these things, to restore salt or to cover a lamp. Because they are what they are, essential and true, and absolutely necessary. Salt is salt. Light is light. And God is God. And here we are again, wondering about the essential changelessness of God. And it's no mistake, we hear it today in Matthew's gospel. Right? This seems to be a consistent undercurrent in this gospel, because a recurring question seems to be animating this particular storyteller. Is this manifestation of the Anointed One? Is this the same God that we have always known? Or is this Jesus the Christ something totally different? Is he annulling, or is he setting aside, or is he abolishing the law? Or is he actually fulfilling it? Remember, this gospel, we've come to understand, was written in a community of Jews who were following Jesus as the Christ. And at this time, just like it is now, this is a highly disputed faith claim. And so for these early Christians, it was essential to understand that while Jesus was indeed a radical teacher, he was radical and that he pointed to the radix, or the root of the law. And so I think that's actually why this teaching about the people of God, those who are blessed by God, the poor in spirit, the meek, those who seek peace, why this teaching about salt and light is followed by this teaching of what it means to fulfill the law. And Jesus does this with another rhetorical device. Remember, he is an orator. And as an orator, he needs to find ways to get this into people's hearts and minds. And so this rhetorical device he uses is called the smallest of these. And he uses the letters of the alphabet. Our version, the NRSV, kind of covers it up a bit. But the Greek of the text reads that not one iota, not one korea will be lost. And in the Greek, what Jesus is actually pointing to is the Hebrew. And this is picked up in the King James Version. You may remember that version that says not one jot, not one tittle will pass away. The jot refers to the yod, or the smallest letter in the Hebrew language. And the tittle is the smallest part of the letter. So the rhetorical device from this Jewish teacher is that no matter how radical you may think he is, not even the smallest part of the smallest letter of the cherished law or the prophets will be lost. Rather, they will be fulfilled. They will arise, they will be reborn, they will come into existence and be fully known. And this is going to be hard. Because this fulfillment, this freshly bringing the law into being, is something that the people of God have had to do over and over and over again. Sometimes if we're not paying attention, we can pretend as if the Hebrew Scriptures are this monolith, which is just not true. Because as the people of God have faced the changes and chances of life, we constantly see them reinterpreting the law. In the light of the circumstances around them, they reinterpret the law of God, over and over and over again. Which brings me back to this question that I started with. Who's changing here? Is it God? Or is it us? Perhaps both. The evangelical theologian and author Rob Bell has said that each interpretation of the law throughout Scripture gets more and more and more progressive. Maybe hard to hear at first, but here's an example. The law of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth may not actually seem progressive to you until you realize that this interpretation of the law was discerned at a time when disproportionate violence was acceptable. And this teaching is going to be reinterpreted again. And we'll hear it next week. And this time it's Jesus of Nazareth who says, forget about an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. If you even carry anger in your heart, it is hard for you to live a righteous life. Is this a new teaching of the law? Or is this the law newly understood? Either way, it's essential. Because my reading of history is that the crossroads where we find ourselves this Sunday, politically, in the world, in our community, is both new and it's just the same. Right? The change we see around us takes on different faces and the frames shift. But every generation faces turmoil and chaos and uncertainty. The changes and chances of life. And so every generation has to come to God and ask, how are we going to live our lives? How are we going to engage in our fasts of righteousness and fidelity? Whether it's in Egypt, in Israel, or in Babylon, in Palestine, or in Rome, or in the United States of America, God is always calling for the law to be fulfilled. The law of love of neighbor, of self, and of God. And that fulfillment always happens through us. Even as the world around us changes in ways that we cannot imagine, sometimes we cannot comprehend, the realization of the law, the manifestation of justice and mercy and righteousness, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen through us. When we remember our essential selves, salt and light, and when we live from that, everything and everyone we touch is enhanced and illuminated. Only if we remember.